genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Ah, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Hi, this is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on every day live, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ, AM 1400, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. You can also hear us streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura County. If all of this sounds like National Public Radio, well, you're getting the idea. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is NPR done right. If you want to join in the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008, or if you're outside of the area code, it's area code 805-639-0008. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is stretching our thinking. Each of my guests will talk about some different way of thinking about a subject we thought we knew and we thought we understood. My first guest is a white-collar criminologist. His general theory of how dishonest CEOs, crony directors, and corrupt middlemen can systematically defeat market discipline and conceal deliberate fraud for long periods of time gave him the opportunity to testify before Congress about the latest financial crisis. We'll discuss his control theory from his book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. My second guest is a fellow at Demos, which is a nonpartisan public policy research and advocacy organization in New York City. He coined the term invisible capital to represent the unseen forces that dramatically impact entrepreneurial visibility when good attitude, hard work, and a great idea simply aren't enough. We'll discuss his theory from his book, Invisible Capital. My third guests are former McKinsey consultants who happen to be brothers. They've examined a better approach to breakthrough ideas that doesn't involve brainstorming and thinking outside of the box because these outdated approaches just don't work. We'll discuss and retrain our brains to generate better ideas with the help of their latest book, Brain Steering. And always, if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. My first guest, Bill Black, is an associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City campus, and he's also a white-collar criminologist and a serial whistleblower. Bill investigated the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s and wrote a definitive book on the subject of control fraud titled The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker praised Bill's work, calling it a detailed and alarming story about financial and political corruption. We're going to examine how Bill's theory is relevant and fresh today as it was 30 years ago. Bill, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Well, thank you very much.
Well, glad to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being our guest. Now, every time there's a financial crisis like the one we're just coming out of right now, observers say this time it's different. But, you know, you're here to tell us that's not the case. It's not so different now than it was at the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s. But let's just lay some groundwork. In 1999, the Clinton administration repealed the Glass-Steagall Act. And beginning after the dot-com crash, the Federal Reserve Bank lowered interest rates to historically low levels and kept them there. After 9/11, President Bush mandated that home ownership for all was a priority of his administration. President Bush used Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae to guarantee all mortgage loans, even the subprime loans. And as always, it's always been illegal for borrowers to lie on an application, but it's up to the bank to report application fraud. So within this context, you assert that modern bankers were tried and convicted in the savings and loan scandal in the 1980s, but none have been recently convicted or even tried in this recent collapse. So state your case. Why should there be criminal proceedings against the bankers today?
Well, there ought to be criminal prosecutions whenever you have elite fraud. In this one, we know that the lenders that specialized in making liars' loans, I mean, and that, after all, ought to have been sort of a hint, were engaged in an activity that was inherently criminal. And we know that they spread the fraud, we say fraud begets fraud, to other spheres through echo epidemics. Now, how do we know these things? So the FBI began warning publicly about an epidemic of mortgage fraud and predicting that it would cause an economic, a financial crisis in open testimony in front of the House in September 2004. The Mortgage Bankers Association, which is the trade association representing these lenders, had an anti-fraud specialist entity called MARI that did its eighth annual report to the industry in 2006. And it said that liar's loans deserved that phrase, that they were called that in the trade. And they did because they were an open invitation to fraudsters. That's an exact quotation from them. And that there was an incidence of fraud of 90%. And by the way, Demos warned in a report in 2005 that there was an epidemic of appraisal fraud. So step back a moment about appraisal fraud. If you're a secured lender and you're honest, you would never want to inflate the appraisals, and you would never permit appraisals to be inflated on a wide scale basis, because of course the appraisal is your great protection.
Right.
So how can you have an epidemic of appraisal fraud while making loans that you know have a 90% fraud incidence? Right. What lender that was honest would permit and indeed encourage exactly this activity? So after the Mortgage Banker Association warnings in early 2006, what happens is, and after the FBI's warning in 2004, there's a record expansion of liar's loans. Indeed, half of what people call subprime are actually subprime liar's loans. Now, who can create fraudulent appraisals? Borrowers have the leverage to create fraudulent appraisals? Well, no, that's the loan brokers. And who do they work for? And whose incentive structures do they respond to? Well, that's the echo epidemic. That's the lenders and the people purchasing from the lenders who say, we'll give you a higher fee if you can make this loan look like it has a lower loan-to-value ratio. The loan part is the amount of the loan. The value is the market value from the appraisal. So if I inflate the appraisal, I lower the loan-to-value ratio. It looks safer, and I can sell it at a premium. And if you were selling as a loan broker in California, not far from where you are.
Exactly where we are. Yes.
Mortgage, say $800,000. The loan broker could clear $20,000 in fees for bringing in a single one of these. So it's the lenders and their agents who put the lies in the liar's loans. And appraisal fraud really was endemic. We have very good survey evidence on that, and we have investigations. And so the Attorney General, then Attorney General, now Governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, found that Washington Mutual had a blacklist of appraisers. But you got on their blacklist if you refused to inflate the appraisals. Now, none of this makes any sense for honest lenders, but it makes perfect sense for control frauds engaged in accounting fraud. So here is the four-part recipe identified in the savings and loan crisis, used with slight modifications by the Enron-era folks, and used by the Washington Mutuals and such of the world. Ingredient one, grow like crazy. Ingredient two, make really, really, really bad loans at a premium interest rate, or yield, as we call it. Ingredient three, extraordinary leverage. That means you borrow a lot compared to your equity. And ingredient four, next to nothing in the way of loss reserves. the Nobel Prize-winning economist George Akerlof and his colleague Paul Romer, both then of the University of California at Berkeley, Paul now at Stanford, warned in 1993 in an article about the savings and loan crisis. The short version of their title is Looting Bankruptcy for Profit, that the lenders could follow the formula, the recipe I just gave, create guaranteed short-term income that would flow through because of executive compensation to make them rich, destroy the lender, and they would walk away rich. And Akerlof and Romer, and we criminologists use the same phrase, famously said, it's a sure thing. Now, this same recipe, which creates guaranteed short-term record income, also, of course, is a formula for generating terrific losses. So if you think of the steps again, grow like crazy by making bad loans, have no capital cushion because you have extreme leverage, and have no loss reserves. That is the formula for producing a disaster. And in particular, and again, Akerlof and Romer warned about this in 1993 in their article, so, you know, a long time ago.
All right. Now, Bill, you stated your case very eloquently. We're talking to Bill Black, who's author of the book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. And I don't think that anybody listening to the sound of our voices would actually argue with anything that you've said. However, complicit in all of this, and that's the way I set up this whole argument, is the fact in 1999, the Clinton administration repealed the Glass-Steagall Act. And then beginning after the dot-com crash, the Federal Reserve was complicit by having an extraordinarily low, near zero interest rate, and then keeping it there for, now some argue, too long a period of time. President Bush mandated home ownership for everybody, and he put Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae as the guarantors of those loans. So here's a banker, whether it's a bank president or a loan officer or even somebody who is packaging a loan for the bank, you know, what incentive do they have to go against this, because they know the backstop of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae is going to be there to protect them. No matter how bad their decisions are, they're going to be there. And complicit in all of this is the government. And it doesn't matter which administration, Democratic, Republican, they're both out there equally culpable, driving us towards this asset inflation.
Well, we certainly argue as criminologists that it is the combination of the three D's: the de facto decriminalization, the deregulation, and the desupervision that creates what we call a criminogenic environment that produces these epidemics of fraud. And so the primary question is, why do we have recurrent, intensifying financial crises? That means not only a search for the cause, but there's got to be something that causes us to not learn the correct lessons from the prior crises. And that almost always, that failure to learn, almost always means some kind of ideological barrier to the facts.
Well, Bill, let me challenge you on that. Ideology aside, we've determined that it didn't matter whether it was a Republican administration or a Democratic administration. They were both were foolhardy in setting us up for this. I would argue more that instead of ideology getting in the way, that in fact, it has nothing to do with ideology. It really has to do, I really have lost my point, Bill. The point is this, though, that...
Well, let me bring it back.
Bring it back for me, yeah. Thank you.
It does have to do with ideology, but you're right. We usually assume that ideology must be one party. Instead, we have a really strong anti-regulatory ideology in both parties, and we have had for decades. After all, President Carter did far more substantive deregulation than President Reagan did. And so if you look at the Clinton administration, its key economic advisors were Rubin and Summers, and they were fierce opponents of regulation. They not only repealed Glass-Steagall far more damagingly, they crushed Brooks Lyborn when she was chair of the Commodities Future Trading Commission and was warning the nation about credit default swaps, which ultimately brought down AIG, and proposing regulations to deal with it. And so on a bipartisan basis, with Alan Greenspan and with leading Republicans. They passed the Commodities Future Modernization Act of 2000, which didn't simply block the particular regulation of credit default swaps. It removed all regulatory authority in the Commodities Future Trading Commission over such credit default swaps and preempted all state efforts against it, including state bucket shop laws. Now, bucket shop laws are anti-fraud laws. That's how extreme the anti-regulatory fervor was in the later years of the Clinton administration. Of course, Larry Summers was President Obama's principal economic advisor.
Right. Well, Bill, I mean, this is a very complex issue. We're not going to be able to solve it here. Just in recapping here, your book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. What do you want people to take away from reading that particular book, or what do you want them to learn from the lessons that we've experienced over the last 2 years?
Okay, we know how to do vastly better than this, and here are the three very brief examples. First, during the savings and loan crisis, very early on, we recognized that there was this epidemic of fraud, and we recognized the Achilles heel, which was growth. These are Ponzi schemes. They must grow rapidly. So we restricted growth, and we recognized the pattern, like making these bad loans deliberately, and we targeted the worst frauds for closure. Second, we stopped a 1990-1991 non-prime liar's loan crisis from occurring by regular regulatory means. We simply said, this is nuts, and we killed it by supervision. Third, we got over 1,000 felony convictions of the elite white-collar criminals out of the savings and loan industry. We worked with the Justice Department to prioritize, created the top 100 list. That was a list of institutions mainly, so that was really about 700 people. So we got the absolute elite criminals in the current crisis, and we did that by making over 10,000 criminal referrals from our agency. In the current crisis, we have numbers on two of the key agencies. They made zero criminal referrals, and as a result, there are zero executives from the major lenders that made the non-prime loans that are in prison or have even been tried.
We're going to have to leave it there, Bill, because I want to have you back in the future. We'll talk about Jamie Dimon, J.P. Morgan Chase, and some other issues as well. But for now, we're going to have to leave it there. Bill, if people want to learn more about you, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Of course, I have a website at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, a personal website. But we have a new economics perspectives blog of the University of Missouri, Kansas City economics department that has a lot of very useful materials.
Great. Thank you so much for being our special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks.